Okay, we have a decision. We are pleased to announce that Super Bowl 52 in 2018 will be played in Minnesota. Congratulations.
You know, we showed that video last night, PFT, on NBCSN, followed it with the reaction by the Minnesota delegation, and you would think that they actually won the Super Bowl, not won the right to host the Super Bowl. The Vikings have never won a Super Bowl. They will now host their second in less than 4 years. And this is the clearest message yet, that if you build it, the Roman numerals will come. And the NFL will never make a guarantee in advance of actually giving a city a Super Bowl after that city has stepped up with public financing for a new stadium. But the message has been no clearer than it is right now. The first opportunity for Minnesota to host a Super Bowl after building that new stadium with public contribution, and lo and behold, Minnesota gets the Super Bowl. It is a clear message, a clear signal of the proverbial, if not actual, quid pro quo. Now, that doesn't apply to everyone, though, because some of these other cities that have got new stadiums with public money aren't considered to have the infrastructure necessary to host a Super Bowl. And also, the past presumption was the NFL wouldn't play a Super Bowl outdoors in a cold weather city. Moving forward now, though, this is where the NFL could get itself into a little bit of a box, because the next time public financing is used to build a new stadium in, let's say, Pittsburgh, now this loose quid pro quo is on the table. It wasn't there back when Heinz Field opened in 2001. It will be there in the future, and it'll be there in places like Washington, Philadelphia, if and when it's time for a new stadium. I know Lincoln Financial Field's only been around for 9 years, but these stadiums seem to only last 15. At least that's the point where we start talking about replacing the stadium. So the cold weather cities that will be cycling through new stadiums at some point now have a little bit more ammunition to try to get that public money, thanks to the vote that sends the Super Bowl to Minnesota. Now, going forward, cold weather cities outdoors, I was intrigued by the fact that Denver withdrew its application because the NFL is still taking a close look at what happened in New York. Even though they got lucky on game day, there's an acknowledgement that this isn't an ideal situation. There is a certain amount of Russian roulette that is played by hosting a Super Bowl in a cold weather city where the game is played outdoors. I still think the NFL will roll the dice again, roll the chamber, whatever it is, spin the wheel, take the chance, because the year-in and year-out benefit of having cold weather cities in the mix with open-air stadiums, that puts pressure on the cities that are likely to get Super Bowls, and on the numbers go, up and up the profits go, and that's ultimately what it's all about. A lot of profits generated by every NFL team. One is owned by Jim Irsay in Indianapolis. And the NFL is walking a more delicate tightrope than I initially thought the NFL would be walking. Because, you know, look, Jim Irsay is being treated no differently than any player would be treated if a player faces a charge of driving while intoxicated. The NFL does nothing until the case is resolved, especially for a first-time offender. Marshawn Lynch had a DUI arrest back in the summer of 2012, and Seahawks fans were wringing their hands about the possibility of a suspension. We reported at the time, and we said it multiple times to get people a little calmed down here, that you're not going to see a resolution of the Marshawn Lynch case until his court case is resolved. That's when it becomes relevant for a potential suspension. Same thing with Jim Irsay. Charges haven't even been filed yet. They presumably will be, but who knows? Maybe they won't be. But regardless, the NFL typically won't take action until it's finalized. Now, it becomes very interesting when those charges are finalized, because the standard penalty for a player for a first offense DUI is 2 game checks. How do you make an apples-to-apples comparison to an owner? Do you take away 2 weeks of his league revenue sharing check, which would be a lot more than 2 game checks from a player? So, for now, he's being treated equally. I think the problem is, in the wake of the Donald Sterling situation, more and more people think that owners should be held to a different standard, a higher standard, not a lower standard, that something should be done to Jim Irsay simply because he's an owner, even though he is being treated the same way that others have been treated. And that's really the question here, and I think that's the question the NFL would not like to answer straight on. Do we, should we, will we hold owners to an even higher standard? There's language in the personal conduct policy to that effect, that non-players will be held to a higher standard. Will owners be held to an even higher standard. We saw Eddie DeBartolo lose his franchise when he was indicted back in 1998-99. We saw Bud Adams get fined $250,000 for that double-barreled middle finger that he shot. No player would be fined that amount. What's going to happen to Jim Irsay? Will he get a much stiffer penalty in comparison to what a player would get? And keep in mind, the idea that taking away 2 weeks of game checks from players, when you're talking about a billionaire, to do a true and fair comparison, you're talking about a number that is going to shock the average NFL fan who doesn't really sit down and compare the worth and the revenue stream that an owner realizes versus the worth and the revenue stream that a player realizes. Some revenue streams may be needed to help pay for legal fees and also ultimately settle or pay a judgment in this new lawsuit that's been filed by retired players. It's a class action, just like the concussion lawsuits. And my first thought is that this new lawsuit alleging illegal use of painkillers by the NFL in an effort to get players in position where they could play, it does have a lot in common with the concussion lawsuits. And from a strategic perspective, the NFL will defend the cases in the same way. First argument doesn't belong in court. It should be arbitrated under the collective bargaining agreement. And then the argument will be, well, the players assumed the risk. The players knew. The players should have known. The players wanted the medication. The players wanted to play. They wanted to do what they had to do. But here's where the biggest difference is. The NFL can argue plausibly that it wasn't fully aware of the risks of concussions, particularly minor concussions. I know there's no such thing, but the mild concussions, the mild brain injuries. The NFL can say, we didn't know about chronic traumatic encephalopathy. No one knew about any of this stuff until the middle part of the last decade. Once we knew about it, we acted on it, and the players knew about it, so we don't have liability. I don't know that that argument's going to be available in this painkiller case, because if prescription medication is available for anyone to take, that comes after a rigorous process of testing and screening and identifying all side effects. And you know, anytime you get medication, you've got that little pamphlet that just keeps unfolding and unfolding until it's that big, and then you get out your magnifying glass and you try to read it all to digest what the side effects are. If these pills were just handed to the players with no explanation, with no discussion, with no advice on what the side effects may be, and the players had no opportunity to say, well, maybe I won't take that medication, that makes it different than concussions, because the NFL necessarily knew about the side effects of the medication, or the medication wouldn't have even been available for them to take. Now, the argument that the players would have taken it anyway is still going to be a very viable one. Same idea that if the players had known everything there was to know about concussions back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, etc., they still would have played football. I think you can make the argument that guys would have still taken the same risks that they ultimately took without full information if they ultimately were told everything that they needed to know. What you need to know is that coming up on the program today, we've got a couple of, you know, I don't want to say really good guests because then Ross Tucker's head's going to get even bigger than it already is. But we do have Ross Tucker in studio in Stamford, Connecticut. He's with us this week on Pro Football Talk on NBCSN. And then we'll be joined via phone by Vikings owner and president Mark Wolf to talk about the process that resulted in the Vikings hosting Super Bowl 52 and just how far away are the Vikings from playing in a Super Bowl. It's been a long drought for the Vikings. The last time they were in the Super Bowl, I believe it was Super Bowl 11, back when I was 11. That's how I always know how old I am, because I'm always as old as the Super Bowl is. I'm sure you're thrilled to pick up that information. Hopefully you'll be thrilled to join us after the break. Ross Tucker in studio. We'll be right back. This is PFT Live. Welcome back to PFT Live, and every once in a while, Ross Tucker takes the position that he deserves two checks instead of one, because in addition to being on the air, he also serves as a quasi-producer, and actually, for today, he deserves a couple of checks, because I asked him, what do you want to talk about? He sent me a list of topics. They all sound good, so that's what we're going to talk about. So, Ross, thank you for making my job easier today, and welcome back to the show.
Well, my pleasure, and I think I'd always rather talk about something that I want to talk about. Wouldn't it be nice if life only worked that way, that I could send topics to my wife in advance, send topics to my mother-in-law in advance? Here's what we'll be talking about during our next discussion.
Yeah, but here's the thing. If we were really talking about what you wanted to talk about, topics 1 through 10 would be the Ross Tucker Football Podcast, the Ross Tucker Football Podcast, and I neglected to mention right out of the gates that Ross Tucker is the proprietor of the aptly named Ross Tucker Football Podcast, and I think I was a guest on it recently. I can't remember. It's been such a crazy week, but it's a good podcast. I listen to it from time to time. I guess I should say I listen to it all the time, but I'm being honest with the audience. I listen to it from time to time, and Ross joining us now on this podcast, even though I don't really know that it's a podcast. Anyway, I'm chewing up all of our time talking about your podcast, which
hey,
I'm sure
no
you're
problem.
Happy about.
Keep rolling.
Let's talk about the NBA draft, and specifically the draft lottery, and you've raised a point that I've mentioned from time to time. I'm curious for your take on whether or not the NFL should do the same thing that the NBA does with a draft lottery.
Well, I mean, Mike, at a minimum, they have to consider it, right? I mean, let's think about the fact that there's been no sacred cow under Roger Goodell. They've left no stone unturned in terms of ways to spark interest. They're looking for something significant in every offseason month. February is the combine. March is free agency. April could be the draft lottery, and there would be huge interest in such a thing. And obviously right now, Mike, a lot of people would tell you, Ross, we don't really need that. And I understand that. But I don't see a whole lot of downside. And I think that this would be a proactive approach by the NFL, not only to get something else that would raise a lot of interest, but also, Mike, to prevent any teams from potentially a suck for luck type of campaign. I mean, think about what it did for the Colts franchise. I'm not submitting that they tanked, and you would never get coaches or players not try to win. What you would do is like what the Philadelphia 76ers did. You'd play younger guys. They would still play hard. They would still try to win. They just wouldn't be good enough to do so. And you have a chance to get a quarterback like Andrew Luck. I mean, some people will tell you that, you know, one player doesn't make as much of a difference in the NFL as it does in the NBA. Well, tell that to the Redskins and the three first-round picks they traded for RG3 to get the second pick in that draft. If you're willing to give up three first-round picks to move up a few spots, you should absolutely be willing to lose the last two or three games of a season that's a lost cause if that gets you the first or potentially the second pick. So this is something I think the NFL should really consider. I don't see a tremendous amount of downside, and I do believe as the quarterback position becomes more and more important that it really is a possibility that a smart franchise, I might add, would ensure. I mean, if you think about the way it is right now, you can get 100% of the lottery balls. You can make sure you have the worst record and get the number one overall pick in the NFL.
Yeah, and I'm so glad we agree on that. I get shouted down when I make this point from time to time that even though no one is going to consciously try to throw a game, the owner ultimately has the ability to say, I'd like to see what the third string quarterback can do. Yeah. I'd like to see what the backup defensive back can do. And you don't have to give any justification. Just, you know what, we have to decide whether or not we're going to keep this guy after the season. So let's put all of our crappy players on the field. And there is a real value. There is a real temptation. When you look at what the Bills gave up this year to move up five spots, they give up a first-round draft pick next year and a fourth-round pick next year, and we know how teams regard these draft picks. I'm sure the Bills, if you're not going to make it to the playoffs, why not just lose as many games as you can and get yourself in position where you can get the best possible player? So I'm on board with you completely. Do you believe it will ever happen?
Ever's a long time. I would say yes, I do believe it will, because the excitement around that would be unbelievable. And I think, Mike, think about like the Redskins this year. They sat RG3 for the last four games so that he had a full offseason program. If a team like that can sit RG3 for four games, then there's a lot of things you could do over the last quarter of a season to ensure that you have the number one pick. Here's what I like. I like the idea of all 20 teams, and maybe eventually all 18 teams, that don't make the playoffs. They all get one ping pong ball. They all get one. And there's only one ping pong ball that's taken, and that team has the first pick. After that, 2 through 17, it's the exact same order. 2 through 18, it's the exact same order it would have been. So if the Pittsburgh Steelers have the number one pick, they still have the number one pick. And then second pick is the Houston Texans. third pick is the St. Louis Rams. So the bad teams would still get high picks, but you couldn't ensure that you get the stud, get the number one overall pick by tanking the season. Plus, there'd be tremendous excitement if a franchise like that got number one overall pick, especially if they already had a quarterback, then everybody's looking to trade for that. I mean, I think it would be awesome. I don't see a lot of downside at this point.
And you mentioned what Washington did this year, benching RG3. No one accused the Redskins of tanking because the team that benefited from the absence of RG3 was the St. Louis Rams. To the chagrin of the Jacksonville Jaguars, who nevertheless ended up with pick number three, they took Blake Bortles. And now, apparently, Blake Bortles is going to be on scholarship this year, if we're to believe GM Dave Caldwell and Coach Gus Bradley. Do you believe it? Do you believe they should put Bortles on the bench?
No, I don't, Mike, and I don't see the recent evidence that suggests that this is a good idea. I mean, where is that? Where is this coming from? I mean, think about all of the other quarterbacks that have had success as rookies recently. Think about it. I mean, think about Andy Dalton, Joe Flacco, Matt Ryan, Russell Wilson, Andrew Luck, RG3, even Ryan Tannehill and Sam Bradford, Mark Sanchez had some level of success as rookies. Even last year, I mean, Geno Smith and EJ Manuel were very much up and down, but would they have been better served heading into this year? Would we feel better about those guys if they hadn't played at all last year? Did it really serve them poorly to play last year? I don't understand where the Jaguars, and maybe even to a lesser extent, the Vikings or any other team that's going to sit the quarterback, I don't understand what the logic is right now and what evidence they have that suggests this is the way to go, other than the fact that they put Gabbard in right away and he was terrible, so let's do the opposite of that with the next guy.
Yeah, but I also think that the presumption is if you're going to use a first-round pick on a quarterback, he is going to be the starter. And I see teams like the Dolphins did 2 years ago. They put Ryan Tannehill at number three. And apparently at OTAs, Johnny Manziel isn't number two. He's number three. I think the idea is you give the young player an opportunity to overcome some internal obstacles and build some confidence. And then you're also protected because if he stinks, you don't have to say, well, maybe he's not going to start week one after all, and then you look like you made a mistake. So you're giving him nowhere to go but up, and you're giving him a safety net in the event that for whatever reason he's not able to perform at the next level.
Yeah, but it sounds like the Jaguars really want to keep Bortles out for the whole year. I mean, they really say that they're going to redshirt him for the whole year. I don't really particularly see how that helps him or them for the long haul.
Okay, you tell me that you are sick of the lawsuits that have been filed by former players against the NFL, which means Ross Tucker's name is probably never going to show up on one. But what's your beef with the idea that first we had the concussion lawsuits and now we've got the painkiller class action?
Well, on the concussion lawsuit, Mike, if the NFL had access to information that they hid from the players, as people suggest, then I understand that. If you've got information and you're hiding that information, that's one thing. But in terms of the painkiller, and I heard you in the opening monologue, but in terms of the painkillers, listen, Mike, when I was a player, I took a lot of stuff. I can remember, you know, preseason, my second year, I was starting for the Redskins. We were playing in Osaka, Japan. It was a huge opportunity for me to cement the starting job. I did something to my neck. And so I got a shot, a Toradol, in my butt before the game. And after, as my career went, that was year two. Through the following years, if I had a big-time issue, I would get a shot, a Toradol. A lot of times I would take painkillers. And you know what? The truth is, Mike, I didn't know the negative impact of Toradol. All I know is as a rookie, I saw some of the veterans doing it. So when I had an issue and it was extremely important to me, I asked the doctor for it. Did they tell me about the potential side effects? No. Guess what though, Mike? I didn't ask either. I didn't really care. I saw other guys did it. I wanted it. I know that they gave me painkillers, muscle relaxants, all kinds of things, not to mention anti-inflammatories. I took those things of my own volition. I wish more people took some personal responsibility and personal accountability. I'm not going to sue the NFL or sue teams because they gave me painkillers that I asked for, that I wanted, because I knew that that would help me to get on the field, which helped me maintain my job. I think it's revisionist history for these guys to now sue the teams when the reality is they wanted that pain medicine.
And here's the disconnect. They wanted the pain medicine, and if they knew about the side effects and the potential risks, they probably would have taken the pain medicine anyway. But now, I'm not an expert in what federal law does and doesn't require of physicians, but it's probably not a huge leap to say that federal law requires, with the dispensation of that medication, communication of the risks, even if it is on that little piece of paper that keeps folding open and it's like reverse origami, and ultimately you got a piece of paper that tells you all the risks. If you never got that, and presumably players don't get that, that could be a problem for the NFL, don't you think?
Well, you're the lawyer, I'm not, potentially, but that's not, I mean, there's two different topics here. There's number one, whether or not they could potentially have a case. And maybe the argument is, Mike, based on what you're telling me, maybe they could have a case, but that doesn't, to me, mean it's still the right thing to do or that it's the ethical move to sue the NFL 30 years later for painkillers that you wanted. I mean, to me, it seems like a money grab. You know what, Mike? Maybe they'll win and maybe they'll get some money and maybe that'll make them happy. But personally, I don't choose to live my life that way.
Would you have still gotten the Toradol shot if they had told you that there are long-term potential kidney risks and other internal problems?
Yeah, probably. Yeah, I mean, because at the time, when you're 23 years old and you're starting in the preseason and you have a chance to start in the NFL, and that's always been a dream and a goal, and you recognize what that might mean for your family if you do secure the starting spot, I mean, there's a lot of guys that are willing to do a lot more stuff in order to try to have that opportunity. So yes, I probably would have, you know, I probably would have talked to some family friends, some family doctors, and gotten a little bit more information about it. But that's on me. You know, I was a smart kid. I could have asked more questions. I chose not to.
Would you have taken a fertility drug to become a Pro Bowler?
No, because I never took a performance-enhancing drug ever in my life. And I don't think that many guys do, but there have been times when I got beat out for a job and I thought, man, this guy is awfully strong. And I can remember three instances in particular where I thought, this guy's crazy strong. I never felt like that was necessarily the reason why they beat me out, but it certainly helped them. But I just wonder, Mike, in the wake of this Robert Mathis thing, and I wrote this in a column I wrote for the Sporting News, I just wonder if we're going to have more guys saying that they took a fertility drug, because there's a lot of public sentiment on Robert Mathis' side, a lot of sympathy for his situation. And so we've kind of gone through the, you know, tainted supplement phase, and you and I talked about this on my podcast on Monday, to the Adderall phase, to now, because of the public sentiment, you know, maybe we'll have more and more guys saying that it is the fertility drug phase. Although I will say this, Mike, reportedly, you can actually get a therapeutic use exemption for a fertility drug like Clomid that Robert Mathis tested positive for, which now that that's public, I wonder how many guys are going to try to find some doctors that might tell them that they need some Clomid and try to get the therapeutic use exemption for it.
And on the point of Clomid becoming the new dog ate my homework excuse, keep this in mind. If and when the NFL and the NFLPA strike a deal for HGH testing, one of the issues caught up in that is the ability of the NFL to provide more information about why a player is being suspended under the PED policy. So if it really was for steroids or HGH or something else, gone will be the days of being able to say, oh, it was Adderall, oh, it was Clomid, oh, I had a spiked supplement. The NFL wants to be able to provide more information. We saw that in the wake of the Robert Mathis suspension. The NFL stepped way out of character and disputed what his agent had to say. Why are these players not stigmatized? Last one for you, and then I got to go. Why are players not stigmatized when they test positive and violate the NFL's PED policy?
What do you mean by stigmatized?
We don't view them as cheaters. We don't view them as steroid users. We just shrug. When it happens in baseball, it's a big deal. When it happens in football, we just kind of like, oh, well, that, you know, he's got an excuse. He's got an explanation. I don't view this guy any differently.
You know, Mike, I've never understood that. I think that part of it is that there's an expectation among a lot of fans that a lot of guys in the NFL are taking stuff. I don't think they care as much in the NFL. In baseball, you know, it's not meant to be a power sport. The statistics are so important. Whereas in the NFL, I think if you polled most of the fans, maybe that should be a PFT poll one day. Do you care? If every guy was on HGH in the league, Would you really care? Would it really bother you? Would it affect your thoughts on the NFL at all? I don't think many people would really care. And that's kind of scary to me that that's the mindset. But in terms of a guy like Robert Mathis and Clomid, I mean, Mike, we're talking about a guy that had 8 more sacks than he ever had. It's a tough year for him to test positive for anything. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, and I think that we all look at football and assume that they get that big, they stay that big, they recover from injuries, they play with injuries, all with a cocktail of complicated pharmaceuticals, and we just don't have a problem with it, and that's just the way it is. Baseball fans don't like it, but that's just the way it is. All right, here's how it is right now. I got to go, but thank you for joining us in studio. We'll check you out tonight, PFT on NBCSN at 5:30 Eastern Time, and anytime on demand, day or night, or in between, the Ross Tucker Football Podcast. Available where? How do you get the Ross Tucker Football Podcast?
iTunes or rostucker.com, which might surprise you, Mike.
Yeah, rostucker.com for Ross Tucker, starring in the Ross Tucker Football Podcast. All right, Ross Tucker, see you tonight.
See ya.
All right, there he is, Ross Tucker of rostucker.com and the Ross Tucker Football Podcast. When we come back, Princeton Day continues. I did not know that Vikings president and owner Mark Wolf went to Princeton. So did Ross. I better step my game up. I'm dealing with Ivy Leaguers today. We'll talk to Mark Wolf of the Vikings after the break. Stay with us. This is PFT Live.
We feel we have the greatest fans in the NFL in Minnesota. I think they deserve the type of venue that they can enjoy and go with their family and their children and grandchildren and want to come to the building and make it an experience. And that's the kind of legacy we have been missing.
That's Vikings president and owner Mark Wolf yesterday talking about the Super Bowl 52 being awarded to Minnesota. New stadium, new Super Bowl, to match the one that the Vikings got way back in 1992. And joining us now, it's Princeton Day. Mark Wolf on the program. Mark, congratulations and welcome back to the show.
Hey, Mike. Good to talk with you, and thanks for having me on.
Did you know that Ross Tucker of our NBC Sports family is a Princeton guy?
I am aware of it, and he's a good man.
Well, Ross is a good man, despite the fact that he gives me grief from time to time. Hopefully not every Princeton grad gives me grief. We'll find out over the next 10 or 15 minutes. Let's start with this concept of hosting a Super Bowl. Is it a thrill on par in your mind with actually winning a Super Bowl? How does it compare to the actual achievement of the Super Bowl as a participant?
I couldn't tell you, but I can't wait to win one and tell you how they compare. But I will tell you this: it's a very exciting thing for the community and for the Vikings and our fans to have this building validated and the community validated that we can host an event of this magnitude.
How much of this traces to the fact that public money was contributed to the construction of the stadium? Because that was kind of the suggestion all along, and I knew the NFL couldn't commit to it, but the idea was you build this stadium, you're going to get a Super Bowl.
Well, in talking to the owners and really trying to pitch why we want to have a Super Bowl, I think the public-private partnership, the investment by the community in both time and money, I think that's an important part of it. And I think it's important that the league recognizes those type of investments. And we had great competition. New Orleans and Indy did put together great bids, and they've put on great Super Bowls. And we're just fortunate we were able to be successful yesterday.
Talk about how this process works. The team's involved, but it's a public effort. Give us an idea of how this is structured when a city and a team are making a bid to host a Super Bowl.
Well, I can tell you how we did it. It comes from the civic business and municipal governments putting together a host committee. We have great chairs: Richard Davis, chair of U.S. Bank; Marilyn Carlson Nelson; Doug Baker, chair of Ecolab; and Governor Dayton appointing some of those folks, and ourselves helping wherever we can in terms of the stadium and the amenities and working with the league. So it really is a coalition that really puts together a lot of hard work, a lot of time and effort went into this, and we felt we really had a good bid and a good package put together, and we know we'll do a great job. They did it in 92, and we'll do it again now in 2018.
How surprised were you, Mark, that you got it? Everybody thought New Orleans would get it again. It's always a great experience down there. People say it's the ultimate Super Bowl city. How surprising was it that the vote came out for Minnesota?
It's not too different than a football game. I mean, we went in there, we were prepared, we thought we did a great job in terms of telling our case. And when you get in there, you hope that your case prevails, and it did, and we were fortunate. We knew it would be a tough battle. We had great competition, but we thought we did as good a job as we could in putting it together, and we were thankful it came out the right way.
Now, the Indianapolis bid was a result of the fact that the Indianapolis Super Bowl went extremely well. Do you now hope that this is more than a one-shot deal, that this thing can be pulled off in a way that maybe the Vikings in Minnesota could host another Super Bowl at some point down the road?
Well, we're going to have our hands full with 2018, but you never know. I do think, though, Indianapolis's Super Bowl and how a smaller middle market city can rally around an event and really embrace it and be hospitable, I think that type of experience has convinced owners and fans everywhere that a Minnesota can do the event in a very special way, too. So they were very helpful, I think, in helping make the case for us.
We always hear talk about the economic impact of hosting a Super Bowl. What's the realistic estimate of the dollars and cents that having the Super Bowl will bring in to the Minnesota, Minneapolis, St. Paul, et cetera, business community?
Well, it's all over the board, but I know, and particularly in February, where it's a down season typically up here, to have that kind of hospitality boost and revenue boost, it's in the hundreds of millions of dollars in terms of the kind of impact it can mean to a community. So it was a big deal for the community, for the state, for the cities, and we're very proud of from the Vikings perspective that we're able to help make that happen. So it's a big deal having an event like this, and it's great for the stature of the Vikings and for the community. So we're excited about the whole thing, but it's a big boost.
Before the Super Bowl can be hosted, the stadium has to be built. Before it can be built, the Vikings are going to spend 2 years playing outdoors at the University of Minnesota Stadium. What kind of challenges will that present to the operation of the franchise for the next 2 years?
Well, we're having our practices as we're getting ready for the concluding a different phase of the offseason. OTAs begin the next couple weeks. And I can tell you our football folks, Coach Zimmer, Norv Turner, Rick Spielman, the whole crew, they're embracing the outdoor elements. We're excited to play outdoors for 2 years. The University of Minnesota has been great, and we look forward to it. And I think it's an advantage. I think it's something that we're going to embrace. And the main thing is get our football team right. We're excited about our rookie class. I think Vikings fans should be excited. I know our rookies are really being well received here, and it's all good from our perspective. So we're excited.
Success or failure of any NFL team is determined in light of what the expectations were going in to the season. We've seen bad teams have great seasons. We've had supposedly good teams have bad seasons. What are your expectations for this edition of the Vikings?
I can tell you this. We're as excited as we've ever been about this team. I know the media and different outlets, whatever they say about the team, we're focused inside this building and we know what we have here. There's a lot of talent. We've got a great new coaching staff that is teaching them up, and I'm telling you, we're super excited about this team. So I think we're going to surprise people. I know expectations out there might differ, but we know what we have in this building, and there's a lot of work ahead of us. We've got training camp. We're going down to Mankato in just a little over 2 months, and we're going to start ramping up.
Adrian Peterson's been the face of the franchise pretty much since his arrival back in 2007. He's closing in on the age of 30. His salary is in excess of $10 million, going up significantly every year. Do you have a date in mind, any thought on how much longer he can continue at that kind of salary and playing football at the level that he's played it at?
You know, I'm not in the business of predicting anything in the future, and I can tell you this for sure, that whatever you predict, Adrian Peterson is someone who is defies all predictions. He's a unique person. He's a unique player, and we're just happy he's on our team. And he brings us the type of talent and special abilities that I know how much our fans appreciate him and how much the team appreciates him. So he is someone who's defied ever since he every day. He's all day. That's his name. That's his nickname, and it's well deserved. So I'm not even going to begin to go towards any predictions, except I know when the season starts, he's going to be ready, and he always is.
Now, the exclamation point for yesterday's quarterly meeting in Atlanta was the awarding of Super Bowl 52, but playoff expansion has loomed over the process for the last couple of meetings. Do you have a position on whether or not the playoffs should be expanded from 12 to 14 teams?
Well, right now I know the league and Commissioner Goodell is looking at it. It's something that is being analyzed. Right now we're going to just wait and see what the league comes back with in terms of recommendations. I don't think anything at this point, my understanding is I don't believe anything's going to be dealt with in 2014. So not trying to be evasive here, but we want to get all the facts in here in terms of what the league is recommending and what some of the other committees that are looking at this closely are going to say. But it's something possible and something that could be worked in as soon as 2015. So we're going to look for some facts.
We've had multiple owners come out and say that they are opposed to expansion. Most recently, John Mara of the Giants, previously Jeffrey Lurie of the Eagles, has said that he's opposed to it. Is there a concern that maybe there are nine or more owners who are opposed, which obviously would be enough to keep it from happening?
Yeah, I can't speak to the vote counting. I mean, we just got through on the Super Bowl bit, being very careful in terms of figuring out who's supportive or not. So on this, I couldn't tell you what other owners are thinking on this, particularly besides the couple that have spoken publicly on it. Like I say, we're not fully decided on this at this point, but it's something we're leaning towards looking at positively. But we want to hear what the commissioner of the league looks at and says about it as we go forward.
Earlier in the program, Ross Tucker and I talked about the possibility of a draft lottery for the NFL. You've been involved now with the Vikings for nearly a decade. Has the possibility of a draft lottery ever come up to your knowledge?
I have not heard of it. Maybe there's been those kind of discussions, but I know one thing with the NFL, and every game is being fought to the bitter end, and it's fought hard, and I think the system we have now is where you fall at the end of the season, that's where you pick. I mean, I don't hear anything about it, and it's something we're good with the draft as it is. I know they're going to be trying to make improvements or make it even better for the fans and the experience, but as far as draft order and lottery, I've heard nothing about lotteries.
So moving forward, the Vikings hosting the Super Bowl in 4 years. Would it feel unfair if the Vikings actually made it to the Super Bowl? That's never happened, where a team that is hosting the Super Bowl actually plays in the Super Bowl. Would you feel guilty at all if the Vikings were playing in that game?
Boy, that is a great question, and not one bit. That is something we dream about every minute, and no home team I don't think has ever won in the home stadium, and you talk about icing on the cake. Obviously, we're hoping way before 18, but that would be something special and zero guilt whatsoever.
Well, it looks like it's going to be a special venue. We look forward to visiting. And by the way, that Super Bowl in Minnesota will be televised by NBC, so we'll be there all week. Mark, look forward to talking to you many times before we get to 2018, though, and thanks again for taking some time today.
You got it, Mike. Thanks so much.
All right, there he is, Mark Wolf, Vikings president and owner. Super Bowl 52 will be played in Minnesota. I'm excited to go. My son's excited to go. He'll be 21 then. He made sure he pointed that out to me yesterday, and he thinks that means he'll be drinking all sorts of legal beverages. And I guess if he's 21, there ain't a damn thing I can do to stop him. So, God, I hate to think of 4 years. And you know what? For all of us, it'll go by just like that. Even faster than just like that will be PFT Live returning tomorrow at noon Eastern time. Before then, just like that will be 5:30 p.m. Eastern time on NBCSN. Ross Tucker, Sean King in studio. Steelers, Cardinals, Lions today are the three teams whose off-seasons we'll be taking a closer look at. We hope you join us then. We hope you join us tomorrow. And we hope you join us around the clock at ProFootballTalk.com. By the way, tomorrow, Eric Winston, NFLPA president on this program. I want to delve into this issue of playoff expansion and what kind of a fight could be looming between the league and the union. We'll do that tomorrow with Eric Winston. Check us out around the clock at ProFootballTalk.com. Have a great day.